It was only later we learned from his friends at work that he said he was afraid for his life, Mary Heaton said. In late August, about 2 weeks after Berkowitz's arrest, DuPay drew very close to Lori and the girls, closer than usual, Mary Heaton recalled. He took them on a fishing trip. He usually went on those vacations without them, unquote. DuPay apparently didn't want to leave his family alone. In his suicide note, he left another clue to his dilemma. Remember that day at Glen Island with the Italian family? I think it's their doing. Glen Island is a Westchester County park located on the shore of Long Island Sound in New Rochelle. In June, 3 months before his death, DuPay, Lori, and the children were in a picnic area where grills were provided for public use. An Italian family was gathered in the grove at the same time, and they and DuPay got into an argument over who had rights to a particular grill. It was a minor argument and it was forgotten, said Mary Heaton. I can't believe he thought it went back to that, unquote. Indeed, it stretches plausibility to think that DuPay's life was mysteriously threatened by people he didn't even know a month and longer after a verbal spat about a barbecue. It's possible DuPay believed this was the source of the threats, but not likely. A more revealing insight was contained in that letter from the neighbor on his mail route, a route DuPay strode daily to 35 Pine Street, Wicker Street, and 316 Warburton Avenue. That note, quoting DuPay's own words, related that something he'd seen or learned along his rounds had frightened him. And the timing of all these events, so proximate to Berkowitz's arrest, is also telling. And there was yet another letter mailed to me. I'd have contacted the Yonkers police with the information I have, but I think you know as well as I it would have been another mistake, considering the force employs two members of the Carr family, Sister Wheat and brother-in-law John McCabe, then Wheat's husband and a Yonkers police officer. The mailman, Andrew, I forgot his surname, knew them, the Carrs and Berkowitz, and this was never brought out. He committed suicide a few years ago after a meeting with an unnamed man in the Pelham Bay Park area of the Bronx. He said they were threatening him, the they is unknown, and were going to get his family. Shortly after, she found him dead of a bullet wound. The unnamed man DuPay was said to have met with in the Bronx remains unidentified. The letter writer had nothing more to offer about that incident. DuPay's co-workers were aware that he feared for his own life, but he hadn't mentioned threats were also directed at his family, as stated in the letter. But DuPay's actions prior to his death lend credence to that statement. And indeed, I think, make of that what you will, it's certainly, the circumstances do suggest indeed that Andrew DuPay's death, that if he actually did pull the trigger on himself, it was a forced suicide. In other words, he killed himself to avoid having the process people come down on his family. And still another curious death was the shooting death of a former lawyer of David Berkowitz. Is this a man named Leon Stern? The outside world, returning again to the ultimate evil, the outside world wasn't on hold while the Radin investigation progressed. On May 8, 1982, tragedy struck once more. On the fourth anniversary of David Berkowitz's guilty pleas, his chief counsel at the time, Leon Stern, was shot to death when he and his wife apparently surprised two burglars who broke into their Roslyn Harbor, Long Island home. Returning from an evening out, Stern, 56, and his wife, Laura, were jumped in their garage. Mrs. Stern was taken upstairs and bound, but Stern was killed when he struggled for an intruder's gun. Berkowitz had spoken to attorney Harry Lipsig 4 months earlier, and now his own former lawyer was murdered. Because of that fact and the date of the shooting, those probing the Son of Sam case kept a watchful eye on the Stern matter. Two Queens men were subsequently arrested by Nassau County Police, and from all appearances, Stern was indeed killed by burglars. Still, it marked the violent death of yet another person closely tied to the 44 case. The last two deaths we're going to deal with here are the deaths of a couple of show business people who intersected with the Hollywood and California wing of the Process umbrella cult. Now, apparently a number of the people who died in the Sharon Tate murders at Cielo Drive in Los Angeles were involved with this particular cult and with drug dealing activities as well. And a lot of them had strong connections to show business. One of the people who was involved in this cult was Mama Cass Elliott of the 60s singing group The Mamas and Papas. She died of alleged natural causes in 1974. But obviously we're looking at this in a speculative sense. It's interesting that two of the prime show business people involved with this particular organization and with the Manson killings in Southern California are no longer on the scene. We're going to talk here a little bit about Mama Cass Elliott's involvement with this group. Later we're going to talk about former Beach Boy, late Beach Boy Dennis Wilson's involvement with the same group. Returning to the ultimate evil. Talking here about Phil Benson, a member of Charles Manson's social set. He's the fellow we alluded to earlier as Manson, too. I realize there are a lot of details here. It's a very difficult book to sum up off the top of one's head, and it's a very, very involved plot. So please bear with me here as I do my best to try and tie up in a spontaneous manner some of the details which might not be apparent here as we plod through the bodies and the gore. Because of the sensitivities of an open investigation, the details provided here will of necessity be somewhat oblique. Benson, that's Manson too, Benson sources said, and we independently confirmed, was a friend of Mama Cass Elliott, the singer with the Mamas and Papas rock group. After the group split in the late 60s, Cass went on to a successful career as a solo artist before being found dead in a London hotel room in 1974, apparently of natural causes. But Benson had known Cass in Los Angeles in the 1968-72 time frame when, out of loneliness and vulnerability, much of which was due to her extreme overweight condition, she began to collect, unquote, an unsavory entourage of hangers-on and dope dealers and entertain them in her home off Woodstock Road in the Hollywood Hills near Mulholland Drive. Of Cass's associates, John Phillips, lead singer of the Mamas and Papas, wrote in his 1986 book, Papa John, "At home, Cass was surrounded by losers and cruel users. They were just hustlers, music industry leeches. If she came to visit us, she came alone, without her retinue. They were sometimes drugged-out, belligerent dope dealers in leather with weapons, chains, and cycles. They were like muggers," unquote. Phillips went on, "They were part of a clique that hung around Cass in the hills or around the house that Terry Melcher sublet to Roman Polanski on Cielo Drive in Bel Air. Among them were Jay Sebring, who was a popular hairdresser to the stars, and Wojciech Frykowski, a longtime friend of Roman's from Poland, and the same boyfriend of Cass's who had been sought by Scotland Yard on suspicion of drug smuggling. Sebring, 35, and Frykowski, 32, would be among those slain by Charles Manson's hordes shortly after midnight on Saturday, August 9th, 1969, in the Tate Polanski home at 10050 Cielo Drive in Benedict Canyon." And still another now-deceased show business person who's has connections to the Manson Hollywood California wing of the Process umbrella cult was the late Beach Boy Dennis Wilson. After the killings, Manson's actions indicate that if he was under orders on the murders, it wasn't in exchange for money. One of the things mentioned here earlier in the book is that many of the prison informants informed Maury Terry and the other investigators that Charles Manson was acting on orders from others. After the killings, Manson's actions indicate that if he was under orders on the murders, it wasn't in exchange for money. He first showed up at Dennis Wilson's house with Stephanie. Wilson later said Manson wanted $1,500 so he could get out to the desert. So much for Helter Skelter. It was at this time, Stephanie testified, that Wilson told Manson the police had questioned him about someone who'd been shot in the stomach. This was Bernard Lotsapapa Crow, C-R-O-W-E, a black dope dealer who lived near Mama Cass. Manson had wounded him July 1st over a marijuana burn, and one of Wilson's friends was there at the time. Wilson turned down Manson's request for money, and Charlie then issued a veiled threat against Wilson's son. Charlie also sought out Greg Jacobson and was again unsuccessful in his quest for cash. He handed Jacobson, of all things, a .44 caliber bullet and advised him to tell Wilson there were more where that one came from. And again, as we said in connection with the killings and the suspicious deaths in the Iran-Contra scandal, many of these particular killings may have been, many of these deaths may have been at face value, but on the balance, it appears that a very, very powerful organization was involved in knocking all these various people off. Obviously, they were able to penetrate the investigation to a very high extent and anticipate the course of that investigation. And obviously, it appears their means of assassination were very, very sophisticated. Witness some of the automobile deaths of some of the people involved in the situation, either investigating or as participants. One of the things we've talked about in the past vis-a-vis the Manson killings was that Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski were the managers of Robert Kennedy's campaign in the L.A. area. The night before Robert Kennedy was assassinated, he confided to them in a dinner at their home that when he was elected, he would reopen his brother's murder. And, of course, he was not elected. He himself fell victim to exactly the same assassination team the following evening. And, of course, Roman Polanski would have been at the Cielo Drive home. Sharon Tate was not around after that to shed any further light on the Robert Kennedy situation. Should also be noted now that Charles Manson is something of a cult hero to many Nazi elements out in California. We talked about that on Radio Free America number 12. Interesting, there is some speculation here, not as much as I think there should be, that the entire Process organization was actually a front for intelligence. And there's some speculation about that in The Ultimate Evil. The Los Angeles drug scene in 1969 could be likened to a field of pyramids which roughly divided the marketplace into various specialized segments. Near the top of one pyramid, the chemical dope edifice, was a man connected to Jets. That's another person who was involved in the California wing of this cult. And incidentally, there are strong links to of this cult to Big Sur and even the Esalen Institute as well. Robert de Grimston, the founder of the process, was a frequent lecturer at the Esalen Institute. Near the top of one pyramid, the chemical dope edifice, was a man connected to Jets, a superior, so to speak. This man was said to have been a former Israeli who had strong links to the international intelligence community. He wasn't employed by U.S. or Israeli intelligence, at least not at the time of the murders. Rather, he was regarded as a rogue who, in addition to his elevated narcotics ranking, was suspected by some of being an operative for the Soviet Union, perhaps freelance. This information, which I unearthed in 1986, apparently explains something Ed Sanders had earlier told me. Ed Sanders is a writer, political investigator, and a former member of an offbeat rock group called the Fugs. And this is the information communicated to Maury Terry by Sanders. There were so many investigations going on out there after the murders, those are the Manson killings, that I began to wonder if the process was a front for some intelligence operation, unquote. Reading that sentence again. There were so many investigations going on out there after the murders that I began to wonder if the process was a front for some intelligence operation. Sanders said that the FBI, Israeli intelligence, the California Beverage Control Board, the Los Angeles DA's office, as well as the LAPD and Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, all mounted probes of the Tate murders, with the Treasury Department involved peripherally. And those were only the ones he knew about. Well, now, what conceivable interest would Israeli intelligence have in looking into the Manson killings if we are to take those killings at face value? And I'm not at all sure that we can. Something it was about as chilling as anything I can think about is the current status of the process umbrella cult. And the most insidious element of this process umbrella cult appears to be something called the Chingon cult, C-H-I-N-G-O-N. Near the end of the book, Maury Terry writes as follows. The focus remained on the West Coast. New information which made its way to me in mid-July of 1986 was specific. Not only was the Chingon cult still active, it now had established strong financial ties with a private college in the Los Angeles area. The cult's wealthy leaders were said to be funding the institution, and satanic activity was in fact flourishing on the campus. At the same time, police in the Los Angeles area and two former L.A. Satanists sent word that an East Coast cult branch allied with the Chingons, the Black Cross, was operating as an elite hit squad for various U.S. satanic groups involved in drug and pornography enterprises. Obviously, the narcotics and child porn details further confirmed earlier New York prison allegations. And as for the Black Cross itself, it appeared to be closely linked to the Sam cult in New York and existed for one purpose, murder. Its function, the California contact said, was the elimination of defecting cult members or other enemies, including innocent people who inadvertently learned about a given group's illegal activities. Murder anywhere in the country was now but a phone call away for the cult's tied to the Chingon network. I flew to Los Angeles in late January of 1987 to interview investigators and sources on the various cases. Authorities in Southern California reported that they, too, had become aware of the California-New York cult link, saying that evidence existed of a cult-operated child porn network, and they were studying possible connections of Phil Benson and his acquaintances to it. And, again, next week we're going to return to an examination of this organization, this process umbrella cult, and we're going to take a look specifically at the child molestation case up at the Presidio. Those of you who have not followed that case, that is very, very important, and I would strongly, strongly encourage you to backtrack and try and learn some more about it. We're going to go into that in some detail next week. Now, one of the interesting things concerning the Son of Sam investigation, as well as the Manson family investigation, was that it became very apparent that both Charles Manson and David Berkowitz, convicted in the Son of Sam case, were basically railroaded by the law enforcement officials. They basically took the fall for what was obviously a very, very large conspiracy. Although involved, they were not the main people, they were tools. And yet, the people in the position to put them away simply did not investigate the conspiracy. And one of the people that Maury Terry makes it clear was very, very active in pursuing David Berkowitz as the lone nut, the Lee Harvey Oswald, so to speak, of the 44 killings, was former Bronx District Attorney Mario Merola, M-E-R-O-L-A. Now, again, for those of you who are not familiar with New York is divided into five counties or boroughs. Each has its own DA. Most of the Son of Sam killings were committed in the borough of Queens, and Queens DA John Santucci, S-A-N-T-U-C-C-I, was convinced that David Berkowitz did not act alone, and he wanted to pursue a conspiracy. However, the conspiratorial aspects were basically deep-sixed by Mario Merola. Of Mario Merola's apparent role in covering up the Son of Sam cult killings, Maury Terry writes as follows. While at Police Plaza, Santucci sat in on some of the questioning of Berkowitz and formed the opinion that Berkowitz was lucid and not demon-possessed, as he then claimed, and that the 44 case might well go deeper than it was presented to be. His own evaluation of the evidence left him with nagging doubts concerning Berkowitz's alleged sole responsibility. Santucci then pressed for a Berkowitz trial, but was persuaded by Eugene Gold in Brooklyn and the Bronx's Mario Merola to allow Berkowitz to plead guilty without any dissidence. Santucci's reluctance to yield to the pressure reached the media, and he was criticized by sources, unquote, for his stance. Still more concerning Mario Merola and his deep-sixing of the conspiratorial aspects of the Son of Sam. Queens District Attorney John Santucci would later remark, quote, "The information about Carr never reached this office. 544 attacks occurred in my jurisdiction, and I was uncomfortable with the entire case since the arrest and had been urging a trial, but couldn't convince the other district attorneys, Gold and Mario Merola, who were willing to accept the guilty pleas. If I was aware of the Carr information, I would have acted on it then. I only wish you'd come to me instead of Brooklyn, but you had no way of knowing what was going to occur either." And still more concerning Mario Merola's reluctance to confront the conspiratorial aspects of the Son of Sam case. On other fronts, in the spring of 1981, the newly released Son of Sam evidence continued to ripple the pond. In the Bronx, D.A. Mario Merola, in response to a question about the 244 attacks in his jurisdiction, told Gannett's Mike Zuckerman, quote, "Berkowitz was acting alone in the Bronx cases," unquote. Merola stipulated that he was referring only to the Bronx and not to the Queens and Brooklyn shootings. While Merola was no longer denying the existence of a conspiracy, his conclusion concerning Berkowitz's sole guilt in the Bronx was greeted with considerable skepticism. Skipping down, John Santucci had issued no progress report since reopening the case, and despite the concessions now acknowledged by the other DAs, no assistance was forthcoming. At the beginning, he received no support and was forced to go it alone. That's the way it would remain, which was now fine with him. And skipping down still further, Tom McCarthy, one of Maury Terry's assistants, speaking here. "He reopened based on the evidence." This is John Santucci, Queens DA. "He reopened based on the evidence. Others created the controversy by lining up against him," unquote. McCarthy answered, "It's somewhat absurd when you think about it. We had 5 of the 8 attacks out here. Who the hell else is in a better position to make an informed evaluation of the case? And this isn't new. He wanted to resolve this in 78, but Brooklyn and the Bronx bucked him when he wanted a trial. Then why not ask him to talk about it now? Damn it, the time has come. Gold is on the way out, and Merola's statement was so cute he could sell waffle irons. This is the guy who in 78 tried to claim Berkowitz took time out from shooting people to light 3 million fires at 15-minute intervals throughout the entire city. Even the cops shot that down as BS. Now he's doing the best invisible man I've seen since Claude Rains." And the reference here is to the fact that Berkowitz was alleged to have committed a whole bunch of arsons in addition to the killings, and it appears that although Berkowitz was involved in some of them, many more members of the Process Umbrella Cult were actually involved in that. Interestingly enough, this book just came out about a month or so ago, and Mario Merola is no longer on the scene. Reading from the New York Times of this past Wednesday, October 28th of 1987, there's an article here by James Barron, B-A-R-R-O-N, headlined, "Mario Merola, District Attorney in the Bronx for 15 years, dies at 65. The Bronx District Attorney, Mario Merola, died last night of a cerebral hemorrhage less than 12 hours after suffering what doctors call a massive and primary, unquote, neurological disorder that brought on cardiac arrest. Listen to the description of this death again. The Bronx District Attorney, Mario Merola, died last night of a cerebral hemorrhage less than 12 hours after suffering what doctors called a massive and primary, unquote, neurological disorder that brought on cardiac arrest. So he dies of a cerebral hemorrhage after a massive and primary neurological disorder stops his heart. One wonders what that massive and primary neurological disorder may have been. Mr. Merola, who was 65 years old, was taken to Our Lady of Mercy Medical Center after he was stricken at about 7 a.m. Doctors said that he had no pulse for at least an hour after suffering the attack and that he had suffered significant brain damage. Officials said Mr. Merola's wife, Tullia, T-U-L-L-I-A, found him lying unconscious on the dining room floor of his home in the Woodlawn section of the Bronx. Skipping down, hospital officials repeatedly refused to discuss details of the case and canceled a 4 p.m. news conference moments before it was to begin. The physicians attending Mr. Merola had already filed into a hospital gymnasium where reporters were waiting, but the doctors turned around and walked out of the room as Mr. Corvino issued a brief statement that said doctors were continuing to treat Mr. Merola. After Mr. Merola died, Mr. Corvino issued another statement that said the hospital would not answer questions about the case, quote, in order that we may honor the family's wishes, unquote. There are a couple of interesting aspects of the death. There appear to be some mysterious details concerning the massive and primary neurological disorder, and apparently the doctors are not at all inclined to cooperate with the inquiring public. So that is to be taken note of. Now, 65-year-olds do get heart attacks. They suffer strokes. So it is certainly possible the man's death was merely a coincidence. But the time, his central position in deep-sixing the real conspiracy in the Son of Sam case and a couple of other interesting connections here raise questions about the timing of the death. Remember, this book just came out. Marola is, I will feel free in saying, one of the central villains in the case by deliberately, I feel, and so do the authors of the book, ignoring evidence of a conspiracy behind the Son of Sam killings. And as we've now seen, that conspiracy was infinitely larger than the Son of Sam killings and would have involved some very powerful and explicitly political connections. In an accompanying article by Mark A. Ulig of the Times, U-H-L-I-G, headlined A Streetwise Prosecutor, there are some details concerning Mario Marola that are very interesting. In the high-profile world of New York City prosecutors, Mario Marola was a streetwise exception. The burly, blunt-spoken district attorney of Bronx County, Mr. Marola, who died yesterday at the age of 65, won only a minor share of the public attention that has made celebrities of other local law enforcement figures. And despite long experience in elective politics, he made no attempt to parlay his success as a prosecutor into higher office. But in 30 years of public life, Mr. Marola, a Democrat, earned a reputation for integrity and political independence among city and state officials. And by virtue of his four terms in office, he was the most senior of the city's five district attorneys. During his tenure, Mr. Marola was known for aggressive criminal investigations and tough policies on plea bargaining in felony cases. In his most famous case, Mr. Marola successfully prosecuted David Berkowitz for the so-called Son of Sam killings in 1978. Does not mention that Berkowitz never went to a trial and that his obviously spurious confession was accepted at face value by this tough, aggressive criminal investigator, quote-unquote. More about this tough aggressive criminal investigator follows in the story. Studies indicated, however, that his office had the lowest rate of convictions for jury trials among the city's five prosecutors. And Mr. Marola's reputation suffered early this year when juries returned acquittals in two highly publicized cases that people in his office had spent years preparing. In one trial, a police officer was acquitted of manslaughter in the shotgun killing of Eleanor Bumpers, a 66-year-old black woman with a history of mental illness who was shot while resisting officers who went to her home in an eviction dispute. The case prompted outcries from both police officers and black groups. In the other case, Raymond J. Donovan, the former United States Secretary of Labor, and seven others were acquitted of charges that they had stolen $7.4 million from a subway construction project. Mr. Donovan, a Republican, later accused Mr. Marola of pursuing a political vendetta against him. Well, there are a couple of interesting things. We'll talk about these two cases, the Bumpers case and the Raymond Donovan case, as well as the Son of Sam case. An interesting item concerning the background of the late Mario Marola. In his personal history, the article says, abandoning his studies in 1941, he was attending New York University, he enlisted in the Army Air Corps and became a combat navigator attached to the Office of Strategic Services, a forerunner of the Central Intelligence Agency. In that position, he flew 55 missions into Nazi-occupied territory in Europe before returning to NYU to finish college and law school in 1948. Well, one of the interesting things about this, his background in the OSS, the late director of the CIA, William Casey, was in charge of all secret intelligence in Europe for the OSS. Now, a number of people who were in the OSS went on to careers with CIA, and I think it's a safe assumption that not all of those are a matter of public record. The CIA has long sought to have people in various positions that could be of use to them. District attorneys are one of the positions that they like to be able to control. Also, coroners is another one that they like to be able to control. It may be that, in fact, Mario Marola never really left the intelligence community at all and continued to work for CIA. An even more likely possibility, I think, is that he reacted the way many people who were veterans of the OSS reacted, although they're not actually in the service. They continued to do favors for the intelligence community. The OSS was, among other things, certainly an old boy network, and many people who were in the OSS continued to collaborate with the U.S. intelligence community long after they formally ceased to be affiliated with U.S. intelligence. Now, one of the things that's interesting concerning Marola's intelligence background is that many of these cases appear to be connected with the intelligence community or with the political far right. Now, the Eleanor Bumpers case did not get that much publicity out here in New York. This is a very celebrated case in which a mentally unbalanced black woman was shotgunned to death by police who came to evict her. The police claimed she threatened them with a knife. The controversy in the case surrounded the fact that many people believed that they had used excessive force in subduing Eleanor Bumpers. Here you had a group of trained police officers armed with, in addition to guns, nightsticks and mace, and yet they didn't use the nightsticks or mace, and many people have felt that Eleanor Bumpers could have been easily subdued by these people without having to resort to shotgunning her. But it was a very, very controversial case in New York. And one of the other interesting things here is that Mario Merola was the prosecutor in the Raymond Donovan case. Donovan got off scot-free, and in politically charged and or intelligence-related cases, one of the ways of throwing a case is often to have a deliberately weak prosecution. Now, in the David Berkowitz situation, Merola definitely messed the bed very badly by accepting basically an incredible low-nut confession and ignoring the obvious indications of a much broader conspiracy. Had the Son of Sam case ever really unraveled the way it might have, and it may be now starting to unravel with this book, an entire aspect of American history and political science would have been revealed that is not only unknown to most people, would frankly seem incredible to an awful lot of people under the circumstances. One of the points that we've tried to make is that throughout the course of our discussion of the ultimate evil is that, again, the Satanism is one of the things that throws people off. The intelligence agencies have long used occult groups as a front for activity. For one thing, occult groups exist at the periphery of public scrutiny and therefore are ideal to use as intelligence fronts. In addition to that, because of the unusual activities of occult groups, any suspicious activity on the part of an intelligence agent using these groups could be simply laid to the bizarre nature of the group itself. Now, specifically, vis-a-vis mind control, many, many of the cults on the scene today are in fact fronts, mind control fronts, for the U.S. intelligence and military communities. And it is my contention, and obviously this is opinion here, but that the Son of Sam process cult, in addition to having organized crime connections and some of the other things, is being used as a front for elements of the U.S. intelligence community and military. Now, I would add, as was the case when we talked about the King Alfred plan, that no doubt there are many, many elements of the U.S. national security establishment which would react with the rage and horror, which I'm sure most of our listeners feel, towards activities of the type the process umbrella cult has engaged in. However, it's pretty apparent that there are other elements that do engage in this kind of activity and sanction it. And again, the appearance of the process, I think Ed Sanders' suspicions are well-founded. It appears to be a front for intelligence organizations. And this is why I find the intelligence background, the wartime intelligence background of Mario Merola, very, very interesting in this situation. It's also interesting that he should die at this time. Again, perhaps his death is natural causes. These things do happen. But the fact of the matter is, the book, The Ultimate Evil, was just published. It's a devastating book, and I would encourage listeners to get out, buy it, read it, take it out from the library if you can't afford it. There's an entire aspect, as I said, of American political science is to a considerable measure laid bare by this very, very important book. As important a book as has ever been published in this country, in my opinion. Interestingly enough, the Raymond Donovan case, which Mario Merola also unsuccessfully prosecuted, has come out in the news this past week yet again. And remember, a common way of throwing politically charged and intelligence-connected cases is to deliberately institute a weak prosecution. Interestingly enough, apparently there's been another, quote, secret investigation of Raymond Donovan, and once again, Raymond Donovan was acquitted. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, October 31st of 87, this is a New York Times story, Dateline New York headline, Donovan cleared in third probe, subheaded same independent prosecutor. A special federal prosecutor said yesterday that a reinvestigation of former Labor Secretary Raymond J. Donovan had found insufficient corroborative evidence, unquote, to indict Donovan on new allegations that he had lied about seeking a $250,000 kickback while in private business. The prosecutor, Leon Silverman, said that in 1985, a federal grand jury had, after an unannounced inquiry, declined to indict Donovan on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. One wonders whether Mario Merola's exit at this time may have had something to do with it. Perhaps Merola had information which might have borne on the investigation in some way. Now, I don't think we will ever know. But the Mario Merola death here is very, very interesting in terms of its tying. Again, it may be natural causes. These things do happen. People get heart attacks. They get strokes. But one of the things that we've examined over the years is how our intelligence services have long ago perfected means of simulating heart attacks, strokes, and other means of assassination to simulate natural death. So this is something to be looked at here. Obviously, the mortality toll in connection with the process umbrella cult is very, very large and appears to be growing. And I personally suspect that both the Donovan case and the publication of The Ultimate Evil simply made Merola too hot a property to keep around. I'm very suspicious about his death and the circumstances surrounding it. I wonder why everybody was so reluctant to discuss the case and why a scheduled news conference was aborted just as it was beginning. We'll never know, but again, take note of the Donovan case. Now, we're going to come back to the ultimate evil. We're going to examine it next week in connection with the Presidio child molestation case. It's a very, very important case, and we're going to be talking about that next week. And again, I think one of the disturbing aspects of dealing with this is this whole satanic business. And as we talked about in the first section of the ultimate evil that we read a couple of weeks ago, the people running this thing don't believe in this satanic nonsense. That is a combination of a cover. It's to bemuse the dupes who get used at the operational level and then bumped off when the cases begin to unravel. And it also appears, in my opinion, to be a form of bestial mind control conditioning. Again, hearkening back to Radio Free America 5, people who have been selected by the National Security Establishment for assassin training are often subjected to films of violent accidents, people being mutilated in various ways in order to desensitize them to violence. Now, many of the satanic cult activities, the mutilation of animals and people, the drinking of blood, the deliberate cannibalistic practices used by some of them are, in my opinion, in addition to satisfying people who obviously are sexually deviant, because all of this occurs in a sexual context, are ways of conditioning people to overcome their natural conditioning, their socialization against performing this type of activity. But again, this is The Ultimate Evil is a terribly important book. I apologize for perhaps not being able to tie it up a little better in terms of explaining all the various details and personalities, but it's very, very involved, and it's just not easy to do off the top of one's head. At any rate, this section of tonight's broadcast, as well as the first installment of our work on The Ultimate Evil, will ultimately combine with what we're going to talk about next week into an archive show that will be on permanent file at Archives on Audio. Now, we're going to have a long prepared portion in the broadcast this evening. It's going to take quite some time. I hope to have time for phone calls. It's possible we may use up the whole 3 hours due to the fact that there have been some very, very important developments on some information that we've been working on. And the program this evening, I think you're going to want to tape if you are at all inclined to study some of this material. The last couple of weeks, we've been talking about last week and then 2 weeks before that, we've been talking about a book called The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry. Specifically, this deals with what appears to be an intelligence front. It's certainly a satanic cult with strong Nazi links, and it basically links up the Manson family and their killings with the so-called Son of Sam killings in New York in late 1970s, the .44 caliber killings. This program, basically, or this book, I should say, in many ways attests to the genius of Mae Brussel, by the way, whose World Watchers program is aired twice a week here on KFJC. By the way, let me interrupt. For those Mae Brussel listeners who may have tuned in last Thursday evening at 9, expecting the Mae Brussel broadcast, the tape itself was stolen or destroyed or whatever from my mailbox over at sister station KKUP, where it was resting after its Monday night airing. In the future, since apparently the situation at KKUP is not secure enough to prevent sabotage by some of the infiltrating hostile elements over there, we're not going to leave the tapes in the mailbox anymore, so we won't have a repetition of this particular situation. But suffice it to say that KKUP is a badly infiltrated media voice. I've been able to identify a number of probable intelligence agents on our staff there, and no doubt one of those lovely creatures was responsible for the theft and destruction of the Mae Brussel tape last week. However, we're going to take security measures to see to it that does not happen again. My apologies to those of you who may have been inconvenienced or disappointed by the lack of Mae Brussel last Thursday evening. Now, with regard to The Ultimate Evil, the book The Ultimate Evil is, as I said, in many ways attests to the genius of Mae Brussel. She, for many years, has been claiming that these so-called these serial killings, the Manson killings, the Berkowitz killings, and others, were not the work of lone nuts any more than our political assassinations were, but basically represented a particularly insidious form of terrorism in which the general public is subjected to these horrendous killings, and it creates a public sentiment for a police state. People want law and order. They don't want to, in any way, jeopardize their personal security by allowing all of these perceived screwballs to be running around. In point of fact, as the book The Ultimate Evil points out, these killings are in fact being done by an organized group. Manson and Berkowitz were indeed involved, but they were only peripherally involved, and they took the fall for the more powerful people. We will go into that some of that information this evening, and we're going to be delving into, we're going to be taking off, I guess one could say, from The Ultimate Evil this evening. But The Ultimate Evil is a very, very important book. I would encourage all of you who are in a position to do so to get out and read it, and it really confirms what Mae Brussel has been working on for a long time, although the book itself does not go quite as far as I would have liked it to go. Now, this evening's broadcast is going to be combined with the prepared portion of last week's program and with the first installment on The Ultimate Evil from 3 weeks ago, and that will be, those programs will be amalgamated into an archive program that will be on permanent file with Archives on Audio. So if you've missed any of the information about The Ultimate Evil or any of the things that we're going to be talking about this evening, they will be amalgamated, as I said, into an archive program that will be on permanent file with Archives on Audio. But again, we're going to have a very long prepared portion this evening. I hope we have time for some phone calls, but due to some developments that have emerged in the news this week, and in fact were rather accurately anticipated by some of the material we've talked about in the past, we're going to take the time to go over this and give it the treatment that it's really due. Now, last week, one of the things that I mentioned was that this week we're going to begin looking at the Presidio child molestation case against the background of the satanic quote-unquote activities of the process, the umbrella cult, which is strongly implicated in the Son of Sam killings as well as the Manson group killings. Now, this past week, that Presidio child molestation case has broken wide open. I mean, it has exploded. And we're going to be talking about that case. That at the time, last Sunday, I had a hunch that the Presidio child molestation case would intersect with the ultimate evil, with the umbrella cult of Satanists. And again, the Satanist cult is simply a cover. While the jerks that are used at the operation level believe in that, in point of fact, the satanic activities serve to mask much more, shall we say, terrestrial activities such as kiddie porn, prostitution, the making of snuff flicks, films in which someone is actually killed on film, usually in a sexual context, drug smuggling, gun running, political assassination, and activities more befitting the intelligence organization that the process basically appears to be. Again, because when you start talking about Satanism, people tend to get a little weird. Certainly it's an offbeat kind of thing, and I want to reemphasize, and we'll state it again, that Satanism here is really mostly the cover. It does serve as a unifying glue for many of the people that are used at the operational level, but again, the people that pull the strings, the people up top, are not, well, some of them may believe in Satan, but it appears to be much, much more to it. Now, let me give you a rundown, specifically, on what we're going to be talking about this evening. We're going to begin by taking a look at an organization called the Temple of Set in San Francisco. There were some indications, as of last Sunday, that this organization might very well have intersected with the umbrella of satanic cults that our intelligence system appears to be using to further their own ends. This past week, a lot of things have developed which would point, which I have actually indicated some hard links between some people implicated in the Temple of Set and the process, the group implicated in the Ultimate Evil. And we're going to be talking about the Temple of Set, a satanic cult, which is, or actually a satanic temple, I should say, which is run by a very high-ranking Army Intelligence Reserve officer, who himself is a psychological warfare specialist with explicit, overt Nazi inclinations, although he is equivocal about those Nazi inclinations. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from last Monday's Examiner, and that specifically talks about Michael Aquino, the fellow's name is, talks about his background in military intelligence and psychological warfare, talks about his explicit Nazi activities, talks about the fact that other members of the Temple of Set appear to be involved in military intelligence, talks about the link-up between Michael Aquino, a man named Anton Zandor LaVey, who we're going to be talking about, and specifically Roman Polanski, whose wife Sharon Tate was one of the victims of the Manson killings, and Polanski himself appears to intersect with the milieu implicated in the ultimate evil. And I say with the milieu, I'm not saying that Polanski himself is a practicing Satanist or anything else, but it's obvious at this stage of the game that the Cielo Drive crowd, those are the people, Abigail Folger, Wojciech Frykowski, and others who were killed by the Manson family, the so-called Manson family, were in fact intersecting with a satanic milieu, and specifically Anton Zandor LaVey, an individual with overt Nazi inclinations himself. We're going to talk about LaVey. We're going to talk about LaVey's wife, a woman named Lilith, who's described as a former coven leader of a New York Church of Satan, which suggests a strong link with the Son of Sam branch of the Process cult. We're going to take a look, after that article, at two more sections from The Ultimate Evil, specifically illustrating the intersection of Roman Polanski and that whole crowd down in Los Angeles with elements of the Process and satanic worship. After that, we're going to take a look at an article from the San Jose Mercury News indicating that child molestation at military daycare centers is anything but an isolated event. By the way, Michael Aquino has been implicated, although not indicted, in the Presidio child molestation case. After that, we're going to take a look at an article indicating that, in fact, child molestation in the context of satanic activities is very, very widespread indeed, something which I think we'd all have to find extremely disturbing. After that, we're going to begin exploring at considerable length some of the Nazi activities of the Temple of Set. And what we're going to be looking at for much of the evening, and this is one of the reasons why I think people are going to want to tape this program or else obtain the archive show, which will eventually derive from this, is that we're going to begin taking a look at something we've talked about intermittently over the years, namely the occult links of Nazism. Nazism itself grew out of a number of occult groups, and we're going to be taking a look at that this evening. We're going to take a look at it at a considerable length, in fact. Among the things we're going to be looking at, we're going to take a look at the site, well, I guess for lack of a better term, could be referred to as the psychosocial climate of Weimar Germany. Weimar Germany has an unnerving similarity to contemporary America in a number of respects. One of those is the preoccupation of many of the people both in Weimar Germany and in contemporary America with the occult. We're going to take a look at the inclination of the Weimar Germans to occultism and how that led directly to some of the Nazi groups which sprang out of some of the more insidious of these occult groups. Specifically, we're going to take a look at something called the Tula Gesellschaft, which Michael Aquino has taken quite an interest in. That is a pan-German occult group which gave rise to many of the key Nazi leaders. We're going to take a look at the Tula Gesellschaft. We're also going to take a look at a man named Karl Haushofer. He himself was an occultist and had a strong, strong influence on both Hitler and Rudolf Hess, his deputy. Interestingly enough, Anton Zandor LaVey's Satanic Bible was dedicated to, among others, Karl Haushofer. We're going to be talking about that this evening as well. We're also going to take a look at something called the Annenerbe. The Annenerbe was the SS Occult Research Bureau, and that also was something of great interest to Michael Aquino and the Temple of Set, which grew out of Anton Zandor LaVey's, his Church of Satan. We're also going to take a look. Well, we can take a look at some of the activities of the Annenerbe, and we're also going to take a look at Heinrich Himmler and his occult sentiments. Himmler himself was a spiritualist, quote-unquote, and Himmler was a practicing occultist himself. One of the things that Michael Aquino of the Temple of Set has done is he has performed some ritual magic, quote-unquote. I don't believe in magic. He obviously does. Some ritual magic in one of the SS Ordensburgen. Those were the castles that were used by the SS for training and indoctrinating their recruits. Michael Aquino has performed some of the SS occult rituals. We're going to take a look at Heinrich Himmler's occult leanings. We're going to take a look specifically at the SS initiation ceremony, something referred to as the Ceremony of the Stifling Air. Interestingly enough, Anton Zandor LaVey, the fellow who gave rise to Michael Aquino in the Temple of Set, also performs a Ceremony of the Stifling Air. We're going to be taking a look at that as well. Now, one of the things we're going to be looking at also concerns the similarity between many of the cult activities today and the occult groups which gave rise to Nazism itself. There's an excellent book that's going to be relied on heavily for the broadcast this evening, namely a book called Gods and Beasts by Dusty Sklar, a very, very important book, in my opinion, the best of the books on the occult connections to Nazism. We're going to be going into some of Dusty Sklar's excellent and very eloquent argument against the occult, against cults in general, and specifically her equation of many of the occult origins of Nazism with much of the occult and cult activity going on today. I think Dusty is a she. It may be a he, but I believe it's a woman. My copy does not have an outside jacket or biographical notes. We'll call her a she for the time being. I think it's a woman. Anyway, she has written an absolutely brilliant breakthrough book, in my opinion. It's 10 years old, but it is absolutely relevant, and we're going to take a look at some of her arguments.